It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the sound of a rattlesnake tail might send a primordial chill down your spine, but our next guest says timber rattlesnakes are surprisingly docile and predictable. First, the United Kingdom voted late last night to leave the European Union. The British exit, or Brexit, from the EU has shocked the entire global economy and sent the value of the pound down to its lowest since 1985. There's now major financial uncertainty around the world. Investors are taking refuge in the more stable American dollar and Japanese yen, which has boosted the value of both currencies, at least for now. Brexit also takes place in a highly politically charged climate, with the November election just a few months away. Sarah Bowerly Dansman joins us now. She's the Assistant Professor of International Studies at Indiana University Bloomington. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, how do you see this shocking vote shifting the financial focus?
Yes, it is quite a calamity. I was shocked last night as I was reading the returns on Twitter. I think that there are a few broad concerns here. First, it's clear that we're going to have a recession in the UK. The reverberations will probably be wide. There's a lot of concern that this is just the first of increasing exits in the euro more broadly. In terms of the financial markets, there's a lot of concern that the London banks will start to devolve away from London into other places such as Paris, Frankfurt, Brussels, etc. Basically, because there are over 250 foreign banks in London right now, and once the UK leaves the EU, they no longer will have the regulatory advantages that they have enjoyed for quite some time now. So that's a major concern right now in global markets.
What do we know so far about how this could impact the United States economy?
Well, you know, I don't think that we're going to see this turn into another Lehman-style kind of broad-based financial crisis. The source of the problem here is not a debt crisis. It's because of a lot of uncertainty in markets and the falling pound. But this is also not another Greece, because even as the value of the pound falls, you know, the British government is in a much different position than Greece, because the British government doesn't borrow in another country or in another currency, so it's not getting more expensive for them to pay down debt. And the British government also still has the ability to use its own central bank to guide interest rates. So we're not looking at a major global financial meltdown. What we are looking at instead is an extended recession in the UK that could have important kind of real sector effects throughout the global economy, which is problematic because we're already in a kind of global environment of low growth. And so for me, I think that one of the big things that we have to worry about is that, you know, as you mentioned kind of on the top, the flight to safety that is being generated by all this uncertainty in the markets is boosting the U.S. dollar in global markets, which is helpful to us in some ways, but it also disadvantages U.S. exporters, and especially in a political climate right now where the trade deficit comes up time and time again, that may be pretty politically toxic. As well, if the recession in the UK crosses over into the U.S., that will also have an effect on the elections in November, because we know that economic distress really affects the outcome of elections, and it especially makes it harder for the incumbent party, in this case the Democrats, to be able to win.
We're talking with Sarah Bowerly Dansman right now from the University of Indiana at Bloomington. And if there you're predicting pretty much, you're saying sort of for sure, a recession in the UK. What would have to happen for that to cross over and affect the United States? Would it be that export market you were talking about?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. economy is as reliant on the UK as a primary export market, that in and of itself would lead to a major recession in the U.S. The issue is more of what are the knockdown effects from Brexit in terms of how Britain leaving the euro affects affects Europe more broadly and the eurozone more specifically. There are a lot of concerns that in the wake of this exit, that there's going to be a lot of political reshuffling within the UK itself, with perhaps Scotland leaving the UK and renewed considerations for Northern Ireland to join with Ireland proper. And then there's always concerns that other countries may start to increase calls to also leave the euro, and so this can really drag down global trade more broadly. And if global trade takes a big hit, that can be a big problem for the U.S. economy more broadly. And so that's the real concern, is that this is going to have these big ripple effects in terms of trade beyond the U.S.-UK trading partnership to a much broader global concern.
Let's talk about the politics of the U.K. exit. Here's President Obama. Here's what he had to say.
I do think that yesterday's vote speaks to the ongoing changes and challenges that are raised by globalization.
President there referring to globalization, perhaps turning the tide on that vote last night. What does this tell us about how globalization is impacting people?
Yes, well, we have already seen this quite a bit in the primary election cycle in the U.S., and so we see this global concern as inequality clearly is becoming more of a problem and more talked about even among developed countries, is that people are increasingly asking, is the global economy working for me, right, or people like me? And increasingly, a lot of people are thinking that it has not worked very well. And you can, I mean, it's hard to argue with people who see that there haven't been real wage growth in the U.S. since the 1970s. And so we see the gains from globalization in large part going to the wealthiest individuals, both in the U.S. and kind of broadly among, elites. And so the question then becomes, what should we do about it? And there are kind of two ways to react to this politically. One is to erect barriers and restrict trade, and the other is to provide more support for displaced workers. But that requires baseline trust in government, and we're in a extended environment in which voters are really taken in with these arguments that government is not to be trusted. And so from a political standpoint, those who want to encourage increased globalization, increased openness, are going to have to find ways to compensate those who are displaced by trade more effectively, and to do so in ways that they can build trust in the institutions of governance, which is a hard battle to wage at this point in time.
Now, closer to home, the two leading candidates for the next president of the United States have weighed in on this. Here's a clip of Donald Trump talking about Brexit, which he supported.
I think people really see a big parallel. A lot of people are talking about that, and not only the United States, but other countries. People want to take their country back. They want to have independence, in a sense. And you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just, in my opinion, more than just what happened last night. You're going to have, I think, many other cases where they want to take their borders back. They want to take their monetary back. They want to take a lot of things back.
And just briefly, Sarah, we see Donald Trump referencing some similar ways of thinking right there, maybe talking about a similar tie to populism. How might this affect what happens in the American presidential race?
Yeah, well, I think that this is going to be one of the major arguments in this election, is what are we going to do about globalization? And Donald Trump has clearly come out in the side of that we need to erect more barriers to trade, to globalization, to the movement of goods, people, and money throughout the world. And I think that Hillary Clinton, you know, in her time as Secretary of State, was a big booster of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, and has since walked away from that quite a bit during her primary. With Sanders. And I think that what's going to happen here is that those, the Hillary Clinton camp is going to have to come up with a much clearer argument for why trade can be good and how we can create programs in the U.S. to help protect workers in the economy who feel displaced by trade. And I think that the thing that's hard about this is that, you know, is that the arguments against openness are a lot simpler and easier to understand. The arguments for openness are in many ways, you know, way more supported by empirics, but they're also really complex and difficult to get down to short sound bites, and so they don't lend themselves very well to campaign sloganeering. And so because of that, it's going to be challenging for those of us in the kind of policy circles who think that openness is a good thing net for the U.S. and for the global economy to be.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Sarah Bowerly-Dansman. She is a professor of international studies at Indiana University, Bloomington, and she joined us to look at some of the impacts the Brexit vote will have on the United States. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll find out how to use the ordinary ingredients on your kitchen shelf to create delicious home-cooked meals. First, we've made peace with a number of apex predators like polar bears and bald eagles and jaguars, but for some reason, it's hard to get people to rally behind the timber rattlesnake. That's according to our next guest, who says the snakes deserve our protection both for their unique role in the American ecosystems of today and also throughout history, and for being the remarkable creatures that he says that they are. Timber rattlesnakes are found in 31 states within range of many urban areas, including La Crosse and Madison, and in general along the rocky areas of the Mississippi River. But although we live alongside timber rattlesnakes, we don't tend to know a lot about them. Ted Levin is here to help change that. He's a self-employed nature writer who's worked for the National Audubon Society, the National Park Service, and the Bronx Zoo. And he's the author of America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. Ted, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm happy to be here.
I have to say, I've never read anybody write with so much love about a snake as you do in America's Snake. How did you first fall in love with timber rattlesnakes?
Well, I grew up on the coast of Long Island, and I used to catch little brown snakes and water snakes and garter snakes as a kid. And my mom and dad, I had the good fortune that my mom and dad took me to the Staten Island Zoo when I was growing up. And the curator of herpetology at the Staten Island Zoo, Carl Kaufeld, was a rattlesnake aficionado, and he displayed every species and subspecies of rattlesnake found in the United States. And so that's where I first was introduced to timber rattlesnakes.
And one of the surprising things that you write about them is how little protection they seem to have. And you compare the snake enthusiast, for instance, with the bird watcher. The bird watcher will see a bird and move on. But the snake enthusiast, you say, tends to collect the snake and take it home with him. How common is that?
Well, it's common enough that it has threatened timber rattlesnake populations that are fairly close to urban areas. For example, there was a man now deceased named Rudy Komarek, who, by his own admissions, collected more than 9,000 rattlesnakes. So some people deny that he collected that much, but he would collect them historically for bounties, and then when they were protected in New York, Massachusetts, in New Jersey, he would poach them and sell them overseas. So it doesn't take more than one or two people to do it in a given geographic area to have a major impact, because these animals are social hibernators, and they come out in groups together to bask before they disperse across the summer hunting field. And if you knew where to look, you could, with a snake stick and a sack, come home with 10 or 15 snakes in a day without a problem.
But even today, you write about encountering people who really just hate snakes or are snake phobic. I mean, there were, it sounds like, early periods in our nation's history when the snake had a positive connotation. I guess Ben Franklin had positive feelings in certain ways about rattlesnakes early on. But why did the tide turn? Why do we have, still today, so much animosity toward rattlesnakes?
Well, I think the animosity, it goes beyond rattlesnakes. I think it's just, it's for snakes in general. And there's a neurobiologist from the University of California, Davis, named Lynn Irwin, who through the years has done studies on primate brains, and she's identified a place in our brain as well as lesser primates called the pulvinar, and that section of the brain gets really agitated and fired up in the presence of snakes. She then made the assumption that it does get fired up because at the dawn of primate evolution, the principal predators on primates were constrictors, and we're talking 60 million years ago. Venomous snakes appeared on the scene perhaps 30 million years ago and presented another obstacle to small-bodied primates or even large primates wandering through tall grasses. She's going on to say that primates have the finest visual acuity of any of the mammalian clan, and we're able to pick patterns out, sort of like finding Where's Waldo. We've evolved to be able to look at shapes and patterns in an area, and that enables us to avoid, for the most part, stepping on something you don't want to step on that could bite back.
Now, even you say that you have had this sort of chilling moment of a primordial reaction when you hear the rattle of a rattlesnake, but you do say that when it comes to their character, they're really not ferocious, they're not out to get us, they're kind of predictable and docile. What do you know about the character of the rattlesnake?
Well, I would say from my personal experience is that they're fairly laid back. The only time they move with any rapidity is when they're striking or when they're agitated and they're shaking their tail muscles. Otherwise, in some of the dens I go to watch the snakes emerge in April and May, if you stand perfectly still, they just move right past you. And they haven't been handled by people. They haven't been fondled by biologists and had their scales clipped or have transponders put inside their skin so biologists could meter them. So because they don't get handled, they just treat us like any sort of forest side attraction and just move right past. I've had them glide over my hiking boots.
Is that what you should do if you're out hiking? I mean, we do have them here in Wisconsin, especially along rocks and areas that have bluffs. So if we're to encounter one, what should we do?
Well, first I would freeze. I wouldn't move, and I'd determine where it is. If you heard, well, if you encounter it visually, then you just move around it and give it a berth. But if you hear it, I would stop moving, look around, and it'll keep rattling. It won't just rattle for a second. And once you determine where it is, move in the opposite direction. They can only strike a third of their body length. So you're within striking range if you're within a foot of the snake. And even then, you just stop and quietly back away and then walk around it.
We're talking with Ted Levin right now. He's the author of America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. And they have, in some areas, been killed off to extinction in certain parts of the state. Where is the timber rattlesnake right now in terms of its population health?
Well, where I live in Vermont, they're endangered in Vermont, they're threatened in New York, they're endangered in Massachusetts, they're endangered in New Hampshire, they're extinct in Maine, and very recently extinct in Rhode Island. I think 1970 was the last documented sighting. They're endangered in New Jersey, they're gone from Michigan, gone from Delaware, And the epicenter of their distribution is Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and the mountains of Virginia. I believe they're endangered in Minnesota and Wisconsin, where they're found on the bluffs above the Mississippi River, and maybe just tangentially out into the prairie grasslands. But they're a forest rattlesnake. They took a left turn when all other species of rattlesnakes were evolving for life in the desert and life in the prairies. Timber rattlesnakes evolved for life in the deciduous forests.
Now, one thing that might surprise people who are afraid of rattlesnakes and maybe even have the animosity we were talking about, it surprised me to write that research has shown that they are very social animals, that it sounds like they even have close family ties. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, they're long-lived, which usually comes as a surprise to everyone. There's a biologist named William S. Brown, who has been studying the same populations of timber rattlesnakes in the foothills of the Adirondacks since the Jimmy Carter administration. And he has documented 40-year-old males breeding and 45-year-old females giving birth. Other biologists have done studies of DNA from skin samples of snakes that tend to bunch together when they're moving away from the den and spreading out into the forest. And what he's determined is that these little pods of snakes, which are all about the same size, are all litter mates, so to speak.
And they recognize one another sometimes.
They recognize each other by their odor, not by their sight. They read the world entirely differently than we do. And I don't believe it's a sign of less intelligence. They get just as much information for their survival with their tongue and with their infrared pits as we get with our eyes.
Ted, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me.
Ted Levin is a self-employed nature writer who's worked for the National Audubon Society and the Bronx Zoo. He's the author of the new book, America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. Coming up after the news, two recipe experts share how to whip up great meals from the ordinary ingredients on your kitchen shelf. I'm Veronica Rickard. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Wisconsin Democrats had a sit-in this week for gun legislation in Washington, and a recent study looked at the effects of Act 10 on education. That's all ahead in our Wisconsin News Roundup. First, how often do you stand in front of your kitchen shelf and wonder how on earth you can come up with a meal out of the odds and ends sitting in your cupboards? A new book, The Kitchen Shelf, tackles that problem with an array of recipes and tips to conjure up extraordinary meals using ordinary ingredients that you may already have on hand. We have with us right now Rosie Reynolds and Eve O'Sullivan. They co-wrote The Kitchen Shelf, and they join us from London. Rosie and Eve, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica.
Hi.
Rosie, let's start with you. Where did this idea come from to kind of drastically streamline everything and still have a delicious meal at the end of the day?
Well, Eve and I both work in the food business. So I am a food stylist and a food writer, and Eve is a food writer and food editor working in cookery books. We've tested and eaten our way through thousands of recipes, Veronica. And we were like, at the end of the day when you get home, everybody else, we open our cupboard and we're like, what have we got? Peanut butter. Let's eat the peanut butter off the spoon or peanut butter on toast. And, you know, we were like, actually, let's look at our cupboard and think about what we can make from sort of seemingly nothing rather than what we can't make. So, you know, forget about the toast and let's make like a really amazing satay sauce for chicken or, you know, a lovely coating for aubergines, eggplant, sorry, that we can grill and, you know, have a really quick and easy but simple and stylish meal that is, you know, from seemingly nothing off the kitchen shelf. And that's really how we came about it, because this is how we cook, you know. We love simple, easy food that uses ingredients that are really easy to get hold of.
And Eve, the formula, it does sound pretty simple. You've got 10 basic items that you say you've got to have on hand, and then along with some pantry items, and then
one or two fresh ingredients from the store. So you don't have those odds and ends of half-used bottles or even bottles with a couple tablespoons missing from them that just gathered dust. Can you walk us through those 10 items, the core of your cooking idea here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to say that when Rosie and I were coming up with the book, it definitely wasn't based, I mean, it was based on what we both have in our cupboard and what we like to cook and eat every day. But we asked everyone from, you know, friends who are busy parents to, you know, young professionals to people who just aren't that interested in cooking. And what we found was that there were 10 core ingredients that most people either seem to buy in bulk and so they always have them in, or it's just kind of their standby that they know they can whip something up, but it might just be the same old routine thing. So we have a tin of chickpeas, garbanzo beans, I think you guys call them sometimes, a bag of flour, a bag of pasta, a bag of rice, a jar of peanut butter, as Rosie's already mentioned, mm-hmm. A tin of coconut milk, a box of eggs. I think most people have some eggs in. And then a bottle of milk and a bar of chocolate. And I think that's it, Rosie, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the 10.
But yeah, so I think, and if you have those core ingredients in, all of them are so versatile and they're such good value. And so, yeah, you can, you know, like Rosie was saying, you look in your cupboard, it's about seeing what is there as opposed to what's not there. You know, so a tin of coconut milk, it can be a dessert, it can be a kind of a show-off main meal, you know, for the two of you, or it can be something that will make a stew that will, you know, feed a crowd. So we just tried to go for ingredients that were super versatile and also readily available in most stores.
I have to say, I thought it sounded too good to be true because these are only 10 items and I have most of these items most of the time. But you look at the recipes and yes, there are some gorgeous, gorgeous recipes in there that you can get to with these 10 staples. But then you also want people to have a bit of a pantry built up to go along with that, some spices. What do we need to go alongside these core items?
So we've used the spices that we tend to most. So we've got cumin seeds and mustard seed, turmeric, cinnamon, oregano, thyme, and a jar of mustard, as well as like olive oil and onions and soy. It's a really streamlined spice rack, but what we found is that if you're really clever with your flavours and your spices, you can go to so many different places with the same repertoire of spices. So you can use, you know, cinnamon and chili and cumin, and you can really sort of have food that tastes like very Middle Eastern inspired, or you can go heavy on the smoked paprika, just, you know, a bit of chili, and you've got a really heavily Spanish inspired meal, or, you know, you can go down the route of Indian spices, you know, like turmeric, mustard seeds. It's just so versatile. We've used spices that you can take all around the world, basically, and change up the flavors in just different combinations. And, you know, that's really what it's all about for Eve and I, is that we like to build flavor. And we think that we've achieved it with just quite a compact little spice rack.
Yeah,
and I think most people do have those things in their cupboard. And as Rosie was saying, it's really fascinating how you just change the ratios of certain spices and you can, you know, your meals can taste completely different. And that's the core of the book, really. And for us, that's the exciting thing about it, is getting to know your ingredients. And as Rosie was saying, it's kind of investing in flavor and learning how just a handful of ingredients work so you can really make, you know, delicious tasting meals out of not too much.
Do you find you save money this way, too, because you're not buying as many sort of odds and ends for particular recipes?
I think it really cuts down, like, personally, and because, you know, as we were saying, like, we both do cook this way. And when I do genuinely quite often cook, you know, recipes from the books. Obviously, Rosie and I wrote half each, and so a lot of Rosie's recipes, I think, oh, wow, that's a really great idea. And there's something really refreshing and confidence building, actually, about thinking you only ever have to buy two things from the store. And I'm sure, you know, I don't know whether you do it, but I definitely do it sometimes, even though I work in food. You know, you're a bit hungry and you're tired, and you go and you buy about six different things, and you think, well, I still can't make a meal because none of this works together. And this book really eliminates that, I think. You know, it's kind of, it takes the worry out of, oh my God, what am I going to buy? What am I going to make? You can just say, you know, like a lot of my friends who are,
new parents, for example, they're just going back to work after, you know, having a baby and things like that. They say, I know I can just manage to get two things on the way home. That is definitely achievable, and this is a great book for that reason. So, yeah, I think it probably does save a bit of money in the end, hopefully, and a bit of time.
Yeah, and also, really, it's really great because, you know, in terms of food waste, you all of the recipes are kind of, you know, you're going back to the same reserve of food off your kitchen shelf, your same spice rack, and we've written the book as well, so that if you are cooking for one or two and you've got leftovers, you can pack it up so easily for packed lunch, you know, the next day, which even I absolutely love. We are two busy working people, so anything that saves you a bit of time here and there and a bit of cash, you know, it's amazing. That's how we like to live.
And you shared a couple of recipes with us here. You shared one for zucchini and basil muffins and chicken thighs and green beans in spiced tomato sauce. We'll get to those in just a moment as we talk with Eva Sullivan and Rosie Reynolds. They're the author of the new book, The Kitchen Shelf. Take a few pantry essentials, add two ingredients from the store, and make everyday eating extraordinary. Now let's talk about this chicken thighs recipe. Can you walk us through that one, Eve?
Yeah, sure. So the chicken thigh recipe is kind of, it is quite Middle East inspired. So the idea is that you sort of fry off some chicken thighs and then they cook in a tomato sauce with some green beans, and there's a hit of cinnamon there, which I'm led to believe is probably less common using cinnamon in savory dishes in the States. But it's definitely, you know, it really adds a kind of richness to a dish. And for me, it's one of those things that it's kind of, you know, it's kind of impressive enough to have and people come round, but it's also, you know, it would be just as easy, to be honest, it would be just as easy to make it for one person. And if you make the beans with the tomato sauce, that's also something that would be really delicious with rice or, you know, like a couple of different vegetable dishes. It's one of the most versatile things in the book, I would say. And also, you know, you can vary the veg a little bit, I think. Do you agree, Rosie, that you could, you know, you could probably use, if you don't have green beans, you could try, you know, whatever's in season, whatever you're growing in your garden. It's a lovely recipe. It's a great sort of quick dinner recipe.
And so for the chicken thighs and green beans, are those the two items that you would buy at your grocery store and then everything else presumably you would have on hand?
Yeah, so you would buy the chicken thighs and the string beans or runner beans or whatever beans you've got to hand, French beans, flat beans, round beans. You know, you could throw anything in there. If you've got something grown in your garden, you wanted a bit of greenery, you could throw it in. So you would just buy the two things at the store and everything else in the recipe you would have on your kitchen shelf. So, you know, it's that easy. And so if you have got, you know, an abundance of other things. And what even I really wanted to do with these recipes is, that we sort of write in the introduction is, you know, try our recipe the first time, follow it to the letter, and you'll be really happy, we think, with the result. And then after that, make it your own. So, you know, if you have got a glut of French beans over runner beans, or you've got a glut of garden peas or zucchini, use the recipe and just swap in like-for-like ingredients. So rather than using the runner beans, use zucchini. You know, if you've got a pork chop in the fridge that you really want to use up, but you don't, you know, and you're like, oh, God, but I really fancy that chicken thigh and green beans and tomato sauce, follow the recipe, but instead use your pork chop and it'll work perfectly and you'll have a really nice meal. And as Eve said before, you know, it's a confidence builder. You get a meal that at the end of it, you're like, oh, my God, I made this and it tastes really good. But, you know, you've made it your own, so it's just great.
We've got that recipe for chicken thighs and green beans in spiced tomato sauce up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're talking with food stylist, recipe writer, and developer Rosie Reynolds, and also with Eve O'Sullivan, a food writer, cookbook author, food stylist, and she's based in London. And the co-authors of the new book, The Kitchen Shelf, which shares ways to make everyday eating easy and delicious. Well, we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you have a great idea for making a special meal out of ordinary pantry staples? Have you found a way to be efficient about this and streamlined? And what do you consider to be the most essential kitchen staples? Do you agree with their 10 items things like coconut milk and rice and flour and chickpeas, peanut butters, pasta, tomato, eggs, and chocolate. That is it. That's what they have. What do you have in your core group of kitchen essentials? Well, we'll pick up this conversation in just a bit. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's Food Friday, and we're getting ideas for how to make easy meals from just a handful of core staples from the kitchen, some pantry items and spices, soy sauce, things like that, and then a couple things from the grocery store. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have some very basic dishes that you turn to when you only have a few ingredients on hand? You want to keep it simple. You want to use what's in your pantry. And maybe one or two things from your refrigerator. What do you cook? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Rosie Reynolds and Eve O'Sullivan stay with us now. Together, they wrote the book, The Kitchen Shelf. And Rosie, you have an entire chapter devoted to chocolate. Why is chocolate one of your staples?
Oh, because I've always got it in the cupboard. You always got it. I've always got chocolate in the cupboard. I'm so excited, Veronica, to hear what your callers say about what they make and what their go-to meals are. This is like my guilty pleasure. Like, what do you make? What do you eat when you've got nothing else in the cupboard but you've got a few things and you're like, I'm starving hungry and I need to eat something. I'm so excited to hear it.
Yeah, I hope they call to you.
Well, chocolate, I mean, we always have chocolate. And, you know, when we were thinking about the book and when we were putting the recipes together, like, you know what, actually, chocolate is so important. It makes everybody happy. Everybody, well, we think nearly everybody loves chocolate. And the majority like chocolate. And, you know, like, at the beginning of the chapters, we've got, like, a three-way thing. So you have the bar of chocolate and you add, and then you have, like, a sort of master recipe. So we've made a really nice chocolate ganache. And then we've made it into a chocolate tart, and you only need to buy the pastry. And then you'd buy a pastry shell. You make your chocolate ganache with just chocolate and cream, and you pour that into the shell. That's one recipe. Mm. And then we've got chocolate and hazelnut truffle, so you've got the ganache, and then you roll it in chopped roasted hazelnuts. So you've got like a really fancy gift, or you know, after dinner petit four. And then you've got a rosemary and chocolate pot, which is a really sophisticated little dessert that you could serve with a shop-bought shortbread or something like that. And, you know, all three of them are just so super easy to whip up. I mean, they probably take 10 minutes to make, and you've got three really good show-off desserts. We've got a chili with some chocolate, which just, you know, it's just a really perfect counterbalance to the really deep, savoury flavours. It just enriches the flavour, makes it so much more intense, with that little hit of chocolate and also that really lovely sweet, salty, savoury edge, which is so nice. And Eve and I just absolutely love chocolate, so we couldn't help it out.
I have to say, one of my favourite recipes in the book is definitely the chocolate and peanut butter brownie, and it works with any, like, whether you like white chocolate or dark chocolate or milk chocolate. It's always such a winner, and just everyone loves it. That's a really good recipe involving chocolate in the book that people should really try. That's kind of the perfect, oh my god, I've got to bake something for the office because it's, you know, so and so's birthday tomorrow, whatever.
Hold on a minute, there is the flourless chocolate and almond cake. That's a really good one as well.
That's delicious. Yeah, I made that for my husband's birthday actually this year. And in fact, my nephew helped me make it, and it turned out really well. And considering a 4-year-old was involved, I think that was quite impressive.
What kind of chocolate do you recommend? Can it be any kind?
Well, we use the bittersweet dark chocolate, but you know what? You can use, so that was what we recommended, but you can use whatever you want. If you really, really like a really super bitter dark chocolate, then go for that. Or if you just like it, you know, a semi-sweet, or if you like a milk chocolate, you know, or if you like a mix even, you know, the recipe will still work if you use a mix of all of the chocolates together. But for something like, say, the you know, the flourless chocolate cake, chocolate and almond cake, because you want it to kind of be a little bit more grown up, it might be the kind of thing that you serve with an espresso. It might be nice if you mirror the, you know, the rich dark chocolate and use the full-on sort of bittersweet dark chocolate. But, you know, like the chocolate cups with the rosemary and chocolate cups would work really well with a really delicious sort of milky, creamy, sweet chocolate.
That sounds great. Well, we have a couple callers to talk to you right now. We've got Austin first on the line in Grand Colony. Austin, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure. What is your go-to recipe?
Well, what we do in a pinch, we can our tomatoes with peppers and onions from our garden. And we always have usually 100 quarts every season or so. But what a real quick meal is just like pasta or egg noodles and ground hamburger. And then with those two tomatoes and garlic and a little sugar, and I guess Grandma always called it goulash, and have that with like a piece of, you know, lightly toasted crusty bread or something like that. It's super simple and even better the next day.
Oh, that sounds delicious, Austin.
That sounds amazing.
And that had that had a whole bunch of your pantry core items there, the tomatoes and the pasta, I think he said as well. I think there was one more. But what does that sound like, something that you guys might be able to whip up from this?
Absolutely. That sounds like our, we did a recipe for a meatball sub. And it actually, you know, it's like a kind of, it sounds like Austin has nailed our meatball sub recipe, but we put it in a sub roll instead of with pasta. But, you know, like the versatility of those kind of really easy pasta sauces using really good quality tomatoes and, you know, ground hamburgers and onions and all of those lovely flavorings and a pinch of sugar. Just, exactly. Really good, simple food.
I can't think of anything better than homegrown and canned tomatoes. I mean, I want to try Austin's version. That sounds great.
Austin, send us some to England.
Nice. Well, Austin, thanks so much for sharing that. And we're going to go next to Marilyn. Marilyn joins us from Dubuque, Iowa. Marilyn, hi.
Oh, hi. I love this topic. I always love to hear people's go-to meals because we all need that sort of help at different times when we're at the last straw and you've got a hungry family to feed.
Absolutely.
So what is yours, Marilyn?
My go-to meal is a cheese rarebit, like a classic English cheese rarebit. And I make it with a couple tablespoons each of butter and flour to make a roux. And I pour a bottle of beer, and it can be any kind of beer, which will change the flavor. And after that thickens up, you add cheddar cheese. And you can spice it with a little hot sauce or a little bit of Dijon mustard. And the beauty of it is you can let people sort of make their own plates. If you have sliced ham or bacon or hard-boiled eggs, you can put that on top of any kind of a base, like an English muffin or a slice of toast. For people who prefer vegetarian meals, they can go with steamed veggies of any kind or tuna, perhaps. But you essentially can build your own meal with that lovely rarebit sauce over the top. And it can be anything to anybody.
That sounds lovely. And that's a recipe from your neck of the woods, isn't it, Rosie and Eve? Rarebit.
Yeah, rarebit. Yeah, it really is. And that's like a sort of classic go-to, you know, after-school meal that my mum used to rustle up for us when we really need some dinner now. And she's like, oh, my God. Maybe without the beer, though. But, yeah, that sounds absolutely amazing. What a great idea, Eve.
I know, that's just really perfect comfort food, isn't it? That's just total comfort food, and everyone is going to have a smile on their face if you give them that for their dinner.
Yeah, and you could even throw that over some, like, really, you know, if you had some cooked pasta or some really nice, you know, potatoes that you sliced up, and you could put the rarebit sauce over it and then flash it under a broiler. It'd be so delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Marilyn, thanks a lot for that. And as we get close to the end here, we've got one more recipe we haven't talked about yet. You shared again. This one is up on our website. This is a zucchini and basil muffins. Rosie, can you tell us about those?
Yeah, well, they're just a really simple muffin. And they use zucchini in the mix. So just a normal kind of, you know, muffin mix, flour, a little bit of oil, chili flakes, salt, and then the zucchini in them and shredded basil. It's a really classic combination. And the zucchini just offers some moisture to the muffin. So these are amazing for, you know, they'd be great with breakfast if you're having some bacon, eggs, but they're also delicious with a tomato soup or on, you know, split and spread with butter if you're going to eat, like, a really delicious stew or something like that. And the zucchini is just a great way to get some veggies in there. It keeps the moisture up, and it looks great as well because you get these lovely little flecks of green going through them. You know, it's a classic muffin recipe. And also, you know, you could, if you didn't have zucchini or you had like one zucchini and something else, you can mix and match. You know, you can really make it your own. You can add in another type of veggie that you have.
And we have to leave it there. Rosie and Eve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That was Eve O'Sullivan and Rosie Reynolds. They're both based in London and they co-authored the book The Kitchen Shelf. You can find those recipes up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. If you've ever secretly hoped you might have an artistic masterpiece in you and wonder just when you might expect to hit your creative peak, a new study might have an answer for you. A researcher at the Erasmus School of Economics looked at top writers and painters, musicians and artists to see what they produced when they produced their most celebrated pieces of art, things like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Or Jackson Pollock's number 8, 1950. And it turns out the most likely age range for being a creative genius is 35 to 39, followed closely by 30 to 34. So basically, you hit your creative peak in your 30s. I don't know, that's kind of depressing for older people. This is why I kind of prefer the story of the painter Grandma Moses, who didn't even start painting until she was 78. So maybe we can all just agree to completely disregard this research, unless you happen to be in your 30s, in which case, good luck. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.